I would also like to thank the organizers for organizing this conference that I expect to be very nice and productive. So let me start with what I'm up to, which are gradient flows. So what is a gradient flow? Or better to ask, when is an equation a gradient flow? So parabolic equation, let's say, is a gradient flow of a functional, right? That means that equation is somehow the optimal way to minimize that functional, right? So we would like to consider a flow that minimizes this energy in an optimal way, that decreases the energy the fastest, right? But to be able to measure what does it mean to decrease the energy the fastest, we also need to be able to measure the distances, right? So when we make one step, right, we would like to make one step of length 1 so that we minimize the energy the most, right? So we need to measure what is the length of that step. And thus we need an inner product. So an easy way to see this, so instead of looking at differential equations as partial differential equations as gradient flows, is just to think about the gradient flow of on a manifold. Then we also have that, so what is a gradient flow? So this equation is a gradient flow if this equality here is satisfied for any V, a test function, so basically for any perturbation of E, V would be the direction in which you would like to perturb E. And on a manifold, right, this would be easy to understand because the differential of the energy is a covector, whereas UT is supposed to be a vector, right? So you need to, right, then what is a gradient what would be the gradient vector? Well, we have to use the inner product to define it. Well, in a simple example of a gradient flow of an equation, is a gradient flow is, for example, the heat equation is the gradient flow of this function with respect to the usual L2 inner product, and there are many equations that can be written as gradient flows. But today I'm going to concentrate on some gradient flows that have been considered rigorously only in the last decade or so, or even less. So today I'm going to consider gradient flows with respect to Wasserstein metrics. So instead of looking at L2 inner product or something standard like that, there is an inner product with respect to which many familiar equations become gradient flows. So let me do that on an example. We have a porous medium equation. So if m is greater than 1, then this equation is called the porous medium equation. And if m is less than 1, then this equation is called the fast diffusion equation, right? If m is 1, then you just get the heat equation, right? So, well, let me not really get into it, but for when this m is large enough, then this equation can be considered is a gradient flow of the following energy functional, right? So for the heat equation, this would be just the entropy. For porous medium equation, we have the following functional, and the inner product is the following inner product that you can think of as some sort of a weighted h minus 1 inner product. So for two perturbations of the function u, so since this equation is mass-preserving, my perturbations have zero mean, and for two perturbations, their inner product is defined as the following by the following expressions, where these functions p are the solutions of this divergence second-order equations. So you can let me just count the derivatives, right? So p, to get from v to p, I have to integrate once, but then I take a derivative once, so you can see that the gradient of p has one more, is one level up from these v's, and that's why I call this some kind of a weighted h minus 1 inner product. Now, the space in which we are considering this gradient flow, right, so for what functions is this a gradient flow? Really, this equation is mass preserving, so a natural space is, first of all, functions that have conserved mass, so I'll fix the mass as I'm doing this. Then it preserves, so this porous medium equation, it describes the distribution of a gas in some porous medium. So it's natural to consider this equation with non-negative. It's physical to consider it with non-negative initial data. And that's why I'm going to restrict this manifold, my set so far. I'm going to restrict it to non-negative functions. And to be able to, for this dot product to make sense and for this manifold structure really to work out, we also need the condition that the variance is less than infinity, which is something that is preserved by this flow, when m is greater than d over d plus 2. So that is why I needed that particular condition there so that this manifold setup makes sense. Why do I call this a manifold? Well, L2 inner product that we had on the first page, right, was everywhere the same. Whereas here, if I'm at point U, my inner product depends on the point U. So if you have some space where your inner product depends on where you are on that space, well, it's natural to think of that as a manifold. I have to admit at this point that the things that we are doing are a little bit formal, but I think this point of view is very useful because it really helps in understanding the equation, and then it gives you an idea what is the right thing to do, and usually proving it, the things that we get by understanding this as a gradient flow are not the most difficult step. What is so why is this called a gradient flow with respect to Wasserstein metric? Because when one looks at what distance does this inner product induce on this manifold, one obtains the so-called Wasserstein distance. And now let me explain what this is. So if I have two functions, both of which have the same L1 norm, then the Wasserstein distance between these two functions is the infimum, where phi here is a function such that the density, so if I would map the density U1 as a measure in a measure-preserving way, then, and I will call this push forward, so push forward by phi of U1 is equal to U2. So if phi transports in a mass-preserving way U1 into U2. So basically, you can think of this, if you think of U1 as some distribution of particles, then phi take these particles and transform them into density U2 in a measure-preserving way. And now, this infimum measures you, so what you have is a cost for transporting each particle. You have to pay this cost, and the least cost that you have to pay is really this distance here, right? And in fact, right, so already here, you probably were surprised by, if you haven't seen this before, as I was when I first saw this, by why would anyone look at this inner product? Well, it comes from understanding. So this equation is really something that describes a certain physical phenomenon in Eulerian coordinates. If one thinks about Lagrangian coordinates for a second, then this thing starts to make sense, and you can get this Lagrangian feeling even here when I'm measuring the cost of transporting each particle on its own. Yeah. So you should think of it as an equation with Neumann boundary conditions. You should think of it as an equation with Neumann boundary conditions. So one way to carry this out rigorously is really to lift the... So the for porous medium equation, if we are in the range when m is bigger than 1, then the initial data with compact support have compact support for all time, only that it spreads. Well, one way to make this rigorous is to lift the support by epsilon, right? Then you have everything, then this equation, right, also becomes regular. It's not degenerate anymore, and you can make sense out of things. Right, put it on a bounded domain. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Right. Right, so... P. Right, so that would be the gradient of the potential, right? So the optimal phi here is really a gradient of a convex function that is that famed result of Brainier. Right, so what are the gradient flows useful for? Why do I would like to consider this equation as a gradient flow as opposed to using the usual... you know, the usual things that we do with an equation. Well, one thing is that it helps understand how one achieves and it helps prove results in long-time asymptotics of equations. So many people worked on the porous medium equation and on the asymptotics of this equation and listed some important names there. And recently, a couple of people have worked on it using this gradient flow approach. So what is the long-time asymptotics of this equation? Well, this equation is a diffusion equation. So your initial data is eventually going to diffuse out, and if you look in L infinity, the limit everywhere is going to be zero. But as it diffuses out, right, it does so in a certain balanced way. And there are perfectly balanced solutions which are called the Barenblatt solutions. So these perfectly balanced solutions, what I mean by that, I mean really self-similar solutions. So what are self-similar solutions? So we have some function rho, which is just a function of one variable. This is called the self-similar profile. And that at any further time, the solution here is just the rescaled profile here, rho. So this is rescaled in such a way that the total mass is preserved, right? You stretch the x direction and then it stretches in y direction in an appropriate way, right? So here you can say somehow it diffuses in a perfectly balanced manner. And all the other solutions, so here is actually the precise form of it. So you can see that when m is bigger than 1, right, then this has compact support. When m is less than 1, then this has infinite support and the tails decay rather fast. And why do I need this condition d minus 2 over d? Well, because I'm considering this as an L1 theory, right? And L1 meaning that solutions have finite mass. And now if m were less or equal than d minus 2 over d, then, for example, these Barenblatt solutions already would have infinite mass, and any initial conditions you would give would immediately develop tails so that it would make it have infinite mass. Now, if you start with some other initial condition that has the same mass, right, eventually it is going to, well, it's going to diffuse, that is one thing, but the other thing is it's going to start balancing and starts diffusing in a more balanced way. In other words, its shape is going to start approaching the shape of the Barenblatt solution. So one way to describe that is that the L1 norm of the difference between any solution of the given mass and the Barenblatt solution of the same mass goes to zero as t goes to infinity, right? So now, this was first proven by Friedman and Kamin about 23 years ago, right? And the immediate question is, what is the rate of convergence here? Now, to study the rate of convergence, I will reformulate this problem in the usual way. So what I'm saying is that the solutions, as they diffuse out, they become more and more like the Barenblatt profiles. Well, one way to measure that is really to rescale the solutions in such a way, for example, that you ask them to have variance 1 for all time, and then see what happens. Does that object, is that object going to have a limit? And I guess that the limit is going to be really the Barenblatt profile itself. So you look at the shape of the solutions as time goes to infinity. So we rescale it, right? We make it narrower and higher, right? And if you rescale it in this way, then the new quantity W, so to find this, you have to invert this relation. This new equation W satisfies this equation. So we have a diffusion, but we have a diffusion in a confining potential. And, well, that is also described by this energy here, where we have the same quantity here, but we have this confining potential as well. And this equation is now the gradient flow of this energy, right? Now, if you're in finite here, if you're in Rn, right, and if you have a... So, right, what I should say is that the Barenblatt profile is a fixed point of this energy. So we are really looking now at, instead of trying to catch them as they go to infinity, we are looking really as some solution is approaching a fixed point. Now, from here on, finite dimensional analogy is really good. So to get how fast, if you have some energy in finite D, and to get how fast are the solution approaching the, let's say, minimum, right? If you had a measure on convexity of that functional, then you would be able to compute that. And indeed, as Robert has shown in this thesis, even this functional alone is geodesically convex. So here I have to explain what geodesically convex is, but this is nothing unusual. It is just the notion of convexity on a manifold, right? In Rn, to study convexity, you just connect two points by a line, and the function is convex if it's convex on each line. If you're on a manifold, well, then you have to look at these things along geodesics. Now, this function here is convex, and moreover, it is uniformly convex, and the constant with which this uniformity is measured can be determined. Otto used precisely this constant of convexity and this finite dimensional analog that I mentioned, along with, right, this approximation procedure and other technical things that have to come along, to show the optimal rate of convergence of W towards the Barenblatt profile rho, which here always is going to be exponential, but when you go back to rescaling, then in that original problem where I asked in the previous page, there you would get polynomial, algebraic decay, right? Now, for the case when, so this is convex in this range when m is bigger than d minus 1 over d. But then there is a region when m is less or equal than d minus 1 over d, but still greater than those constants. It has to be greater than this d minus 2 over d, where we still have Barenblatt solutions, and Friedman and Kaminski have still proven that they govern the long-time asymptotics, but this convexity doesn't work anymore. What one can do in that case, and what Robert and Danzler have done, is, well, let's look at just the linearized problem at that point there. Again, the reason, so the fact that they looked at this as a gradient flow enables you really to easily linearize this equation. So if one tries to linearize this equation directly, which people have done, what one obtains is operator that is not self-adjoint, for which it is very hard to obtain estimates. And people really have tried that and published papers on that with estimates that were precisely half as good as the optimal estimates. So by looking at this linear dynamics on a manifold, right, the near a fixed point, it is described by the Hessian of this. And the Hessian on a manifold, right, is always going to be a symmetric operator. So when one computes this and very nice algebraic things happen here, one is able to obtain, Robert and Danzler have obtained, the full spectrum of this equation and hence predicted the optimal rates. Now this prediction, so in the case where we are really in this gradient flow setting, Robert and I were able to really show that this is true not just in linearized case, but also really true asymptotically. And what happens here is that although the functional is not convex, it happens that along the curves of the solution, it is going to be convex, right? And as it is approaching these fixed points, right, the measure of the convexity is really going to be epsilon close to the measure of the convexity of the linearized equation. I should also mention that in that other region where this gradient flow doesn't work out directly, Yang-Jiang Kim, who is also a postdoc here, and Robert have used other techniques, but very nice techniques as well, to obtain optimal rate of convergence. So we have seen one use of gradient flows, which is to look at long-time asymptotics of equations. But let me now try to apply gradient flows to a different set of equations, which I find to be rather interesting, have richer dynamics than porous medium and equations that you have seen so far. So let me just consider this equation on in 1D. It makes sense in higher D, but the analysis still is pretty far from being developed. So this gradient flow formulation works in higher D, but some of the analytical properties, we just don't have to make full sense of that. So this is called a long wave unstable thin film equation. If I didn't have this term, that would be just the thin film equation, which describes the evolution of a thin layer of a liquid and a solid substrate. But this term here, so if you just think of the second term alone, that would be like the porous medium equation, but with the wrong sign, right? So this would be an ill-posed problem if it weren't for this fourth order diffusion. That's why this is a destabilizing term, and it describes effects such as gravity acting on that. So this term describes the effects of the surface tension, which tries to make the film flatter, whereas this term here describes the effects of gravity, which try to form drops that would fall off the ceiling. Of course, for different M and N are both positive, where different effects can be described. What is interesting about this equation, well, first of all, you can see that it's in divergent form, so it preserves mass. But what is more interesting, that unlike the linear fourth-order equations, it preserves the positivity of solutions. So it really describes this physical quantity, which is the, so U would be the height of the film. And it is a gradient flow of the following functional here. So you can see that this function now is definitely not going to be convex. The inner product is similar to the one that we have seen before, only that this weight here now has changed. And that makes sometimes a big difference. When n is equal to 1, then we precisely have the Wasserstein distance that we had before. Right, so let's try to understand these equations just a little bit to be able to speak about them. Right, so the question is, well, let me try to understand the interaction of this destabilizing and stabilizing term. Let me see very naively when are these two terms going to be in balance. So when do I have a chance of having those self-similar solutions that are perfectly balanced? So if this is the height extent and this is the length extent of some layer of fluid that I'm saying, well, maybe it is blowing up in a balanced way, right? Then this first term has the dimensions of this dimension here. The second term has this dimension here. If I'm assuming that this thing happens self-similarly, again, because of the preservation of mass, I have that length scale has to be like 1 over the vertical extent, and that gives me that these two terms scale like the following powers of h, and I see that these terms are going to be in balance when m is equal to n plus 2. So you can see that if m is less than n plus 2, right, so then this destabilizing term is supposed to be weaker than the stabilizing term, and we should expect long-time solutions, and that is indeed the case, and that was proven by Andrea Bertozzi and Mary Pugh. Now, if m is equal to n plus 2, then we see that there may exist self-similar solutions, but one has to, no one guarantees that they indeed do. So one has to check if that is true. So if one plugs in this ansatz and tries to find the profile that, for example, is the profile of a self-similar spreading solution, then one sees that such profiles can exist only if n is between 0 and 3. And this has some deep reasons in where this equation comes from, and it's not really surprising when one looks at the physics of this equation. So this was obtained by Elena Beretta. Self-similar blow-up solutions are a little bit harder, so the dynamical system, well, the ODE or the dynamical system that you get when you start to study this is a little bit harder, and so Mary and I were working on this. And we found out that such solutions exist only when n is between 0 and 3 halves. And there are several families of these solutions. So there are single bump solutions which have one local maximum, but there are also solutions with any number of local maxima. These are called monthly bump solutions. Now, in the case when m is greater than n plus 2, then it is conjectured that blow up is possible. So I would say that there are many data, initial data, that do blow up. Right. So by using this gradient flow structure of these equations, we can again study the stability. And first of all, let's start with the linearized stability. So the steady state that exists always, not depending on values of m and n, are steady states. These are also self-similar solutions that don't change in time. And their stability, we studied using the tools that Robert and Denslow have developed. So in particular, and I should certainly mention Otto, who started really and first used this gradient flow approach to really prove something. So, well, first of all, we have that Hessian is symmetric, but also the way this inner product is constructed suggests a particular set of coordinates in which to look at, in which to linearize. So in particular, instead of looking at perturbation V, we can look, in one-dimensional case at least, at the vector field, such that if you take, so I'm linearizing around eta, if you take eta, and so if you were to transport it infinitesimally by this vector field V, by this vector field F, you would get this perturbation in Eulerian coordinates given by V. The inner product that we define for Vs really comes as from the inner product that can be defined on Fs, but the inner product on Fs is just the weighted L2 inner product. So something that is much nicer and easier to understand than that product on Vs. Also, in these F coordinates, the geodesics are easy to understand. Geodesic, here parameterized by S, is just the push forward of the identity map plus S times F of this density eta around which we are linearizing. And now, to compute the Hessian, one just has to take second derivatives along geodesics. Well, since my geodesics is not arc length parameterized, I have to reparameterize it here. And this is the quadratic form that we get there. Right? So we are not lucky, as Robert was in his case, that nice algebraic things happen. And in particular, we don't even know the exact form of eta. So Barnblatt profiles are known exactly, but these etas are not known exactly. But since we chose these very nice coordinates, we got a functional that we can still easily understand. So in particular, I forgot to say a big thing, but I hope that the letters were big enough. I'm doing this in the case n is equal to 1, when I have exactly Wasserstein distance, where things are easier to do. That's why these are geodesics, otherwise it wouldn't be true. Now, yeah? Right. So, one thing that we can see that if you look at translations, there, this Hessian is equal to 0, right? Both of these derivatives are going to be 0, and that is natural because this equation is, if you translate it, it's invariant under translation, so you cannot expect any stability or instability in that direction. But now if we look at the vector field x, which corresponds to dilating eta, we see that if m is bigger than 3, well, you can see this term here is 0, this term is going to be negative, so we have that this Hessian quadratic form is negative, and thus dilations represent an unstable direction. So the droplets there are expected to break up into several droplets and then eventually probably blow up. If m is equal to 3, then this is a neutral direction. If m is less than 3, then it is a stable direction, but it is true in both. So it is true that modulo translations, in this case, the dynamics is stable, meaning that there exists a positive constant lambda such that this Hessian quadratic form is positive for any vector field that is orthogonal to translations, right? And now let me just mention in a second what goes into proving this. Well, it is the same as in this second case. If we mod out also translations and dilations, this is when m is equal to 3, this still would be greater than some lambda. So let's just forget about this term. And then we have here eta squared fxx squared divided by eta f squared. What I would like to point out is that this stability depends really on the form of eta and on how fast it detaches here from the line. If it were to detach from the line too slowly, then this quotient here, in fact, the infimum of h of f would in fact be equal to 0. So no positive lambda here would work. Right. Okay, now let's consider the more interesting things, which is stability of really self-similar solutions. For spreading solutions, it's easy. They are even more stable, right, as we should expect, than, I think I have 3 minutes, right? Or so. Right, from where I started. So, right, so spreading self-similar solutions are easy. So I'll look at the stability of blow-up profiles. Now, when one does, again, goes to similarity variables, this is the equation one obtains. It is the gradient flow of this energy, and this is the Hessian that one computes. What I would like to point out right here, this term is trying to make this positive, but both of these terms are always going to be negative, right? So it is hard, really, to establish stability of this. And particularly, we can see right away that both translations and dilations are going to be negative. But this is expected because we are linearizing around the blow-up profile. You see, in the original coordinates, right, if you take a profile that is going to blow up and you move it just a little bit by side, originally their L1 difference may be very small, but as they start to concentrate and each goes to a separate point, their L1 difference is going to go to, well, the sum of their masses, right? So whenever you're going to these similarity variables for the blow-up coordinates, you're going to have that translations are unstable directions, and also the dilations. Dilations are related to, if you dilate it originally, it is going to, let's say, blow up sooner. So at that time, the difference is going to grow and become very large. But that is not a problem, right? That is just comes from not, you see, we are studying whether these blow-up profiles are stable, whether they really govern how blow-up happens. These two instability are related, so if we miss a little bit the place or we miss a little bit the time, but we are interested in do these self-similar blow-up profiles really describe how the blow-up happens? And so I was able to prove that that is indeed so, right? So if one mods out both translations and dilations, then there exists a constant lambda, again, for those blow-up profiles that Mary and I constructed, right? So we are not able to prove that those are the only blow-up profiles and so on. For multi-bound blow-up profiles, one can show that in addition to these two unstable directions, there are more unstable directions. So now we have the conjectured picture, right? Single bump profiles are stable. They govern the blow-up. If you start with a, let's say, triple bump profile, these bumps are going to get unstable, and probably one is going to blow up sooner than the others, which describes why these multi-bump solutions are unstable. So there are many questions about the dynamics of these thin film equations that I would be happy to discuss. So I'm going to just put these future directions and open problems on and stop here.